Michelangelo Signorelli Show.
We speak so much on the program about immigration policy and certainly current immigration policy and refugees and the experience of refugees and what this country is about and what it should be about. And we don't often get a chance to speak to someone who has been a refugee and has very much advocated and spoke about the experience. And my guest has, in a very eloquent way, in a new book, The Ungrateful Refugee, What Immigrants Never Tell You. Dina Nayeri was born in Iran during the revolution, arrived in the U.S. when she was 10 years old. She is a writer who has won multiple awards, the UNESCO City of Literature Paul Eagle Prize and a National Endowment for the Arts Literature Grant, finalist for the Rome Prize and a grant to New Voices Project pick. She's the author of two novels, and this is her first nonfiction book in which she's sharing some very real and important stories. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
So you are a refugee, and it's something I think a lot of people don't understand and really quite grasp the difference when they talk about people who are immigrants versus people who are refugees. So talk a little bit about what does that mean as a refugee?
Yeah. Well, a refugee has a very specific definition. It's someone who escaped their country and is seeking asylum in another country because they fear persecution on the basis of political opinion, religion, sexual orientation, race, or membership in a particular social group. So, you know, immigrants are kind of a wider group. Anybody who's gone from one country to another and has uprooted and is moving, whereas refugees are very specifically threatened for those reasons.
And you, in the book, write about your experiences as a refugee whose family fled Iran.
Mm-hmm.
You were 8 years old. It was during the revolution. And you reflect on how it's relevant as well to what we're seeing now, current administration policies. Your mother, a Christian, was singled out by the government for her religious practices. Talk a little bit about how your family came to flee Iran.
Mm-hmm. Well, my mother, she wasn't just a Christian. She was a Christian convert. And that is a very important difference in Iran, because in Iran, there are communities of Assyrians and Armenians who are largely left alone because they were born Christian, as long as they don't proselytize. And my mother did proselytize, but she was also a convert from Islam. So that alone, made her kind of put her in danger of being arrested and put to death. But you know, she was also just like involved in the underground church and in like, you know, secret radio into the villages, and she was doing everything she could to get herself into trouble. And of course, eventually she was arrested and she was threatened with execution. And so we escaped to Dubai, where we became undocumented.
And eventually to the United States.
Yes. We were in a refugee camp in Italy, and then eventually we were taken by the U.S.
Talk a little bit about that experience, too, because, again, people think today about people who are refugees. You spend an enormous amount of time before you even get here processing in a refugee camp.
Yes, yes. Well, in my experience, I mean, we were refugees for 16, or we were asylum seekers. That's before you are recognized as a refugee, for 16 months. And that time was brutal in so many ways, because first of all, you know, you have no money and you're not allowed to work and you don't have a school to go to. So you're completely idle with no resources and you don't know when that waiting time will end. I think that's the biggest torture, I suppose, of the refugee camps, is not knowing when it'll be over, and it could be years.
Mm-hmm. You, from an early age, grappled with other people's expectations about how grateful, and that's the term you use in the title, The Ungrateful Refugee, how grateful you should feel all of the time in America. And you would say to yourself, I'm a rescue cargo. I will prove, repay, and transform. Tell us about that pressure to fit in.
Yeah, I mean, I think the pressure to fit in was largely from myself. I mean, I wanted to feel at home again. I had been uprooted from a good life, you know, except for the Islamic Republic and except for, you know, the dangers to us because we were Christians. Iran is a beautiful place full of my family, full of the people that I loved. And so knowing that we would never go back, I wanted very much to feel at home again, to be part of a community, to be loved and not feel like I was different. But there was this constant expectation of, you know, for us to not only prove ourselves, but to always be kind of bowing down and saying, you know, we're so happy to be here, to constantly offer up our story for, you know, the entertainment of people around us. And it wasn't really the best thing for us or the best way to use our talents or resources. I mean, we wanted to plug in and be useful and go and get educations and do our best in the West. And I think it was very much harder when we were constantly pushed into this particular category. And I think a lot of times it happens very unconsciously by very well-meaning people, you know, and I think this is one of the reasons that I wrote the book. It's because, you know, it does come from a place of extreme love and extreme gratitude. But what I'm trying to say to, you know, the native born is that there are things that you do accidentally, you know, when you think you're being loving, you know, maybe asking for those escape stories instead of what our lives were, you know, and making us relive that trauma, or maybe, you know, giving charity in such a big obvious way that it robs us of our dignity. I mean, so in the book, I talk about all the ways that we kind of shrink into ourselves because of what happens accidentally, because, you know, it's a cultural issue. The native born have never been displaced, and so they don't know how to behave with us, even when they're being loving. So I hope that the book helps these two groups get along.
Well, and also just getting back to that process, too, people don't understand the process. I mean, especially now people seeing refugees and they think it's such an easy process. Yeah. And yet it's not just the process of living in the refugee camp. It's the letters. Mm-hmm. It's the back and forth. It's the
even trying to get asylum.
Yes.
Oh, it is. You know, one of the things that really truly shocked me, and it's going to be the subject, I think, of my next book too, but it's largely addressed in this one, is that we think our gatekeepers are scientific and professional and that they've got this. They don't. They're not really trained for, you know, understanding people's stories, understanding political situations in other countries, understanding trauma. And, you know, they work in these asylum offices, and this is true across Europe and in the US, that have this culture of disbelief. More and more as the years pass, it's they don't see their role as, you know, saving the outcasts of the world, the people whose lives are in danger. They don't see a humanitarian role in their job. They see their job as weeding out the discrepancies and catching the discrepancies and to turning people away. And that shouldn't be what they see as their job.
Right. And from what we can see, that's worse now.
Yes, it's a lot worse. You know. I just also want to say that the definition of refugee itself, in my opinion, is extremely problematic, because how can you possibly judge that this person, because they went through a particular kind of danger, deserves refuge, and another person who went through a different but equally dangerous situation doesn't deserve it simply because, you know, it's not, doesn't perfectly fit the definition of, you know, political opinion, religious affiliation, etc. Maybe they were in danger because their country is riddled with gang violence.
Which is so much of what we're seeing now. And people seeking asylum and trying to get away from violence.
Exactly.
And risking everything to do that. Mm-hmm. And some people in this country, in this government, still not understanding that or not wanting to understand that and deeming them as dangerous.
No, exactly. And I think, you know, if you listen to some of the asylum interviews in some of these border cases, you would be appalled at the kind of parsing of motivations that they do to try to determine if someone is quote unquote a real refugee. You know, let's say your you know, family was threatened by a gang and you ran away and the gang had demanded money. You know, if they ask you at the border, why didn't you pay? You know, and you say, because I didn't have money, well, then you are not a refugee because it was about money. Mm-hmm. If you say, because I don't believe gangs should be running my country, well, then you are a refugee because that's a political opinion. How on earth is a person supposed to know that that's what they need to say when they arrive at the border? Mm-hmm. Of course they don't. And of course, the actual reasons are mixed and varied and they are layered upon each other. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I have a big problem with the fact that we put ourselves in the position of judging other people's suffering. Who is suffering enough? Who is suffering in exactly the right way? This mm-hmm. is not the country that we have claimed to be for so many decades.
Mm-hmm. So true. The book is The Ungrateful Refugee, What Immigrants Never Tell You. Dina Nayeri is the author and my guest. I'm Michelangelo Signorelli on Sirius XM Progress 127. Discussing that upbringing and the way people respond, you write about how you were a star student in elementary school, lived a very comfortable life to medical professionals as mm-hmm. your parents. And then, you know, your family ends up in Oklahoma and you're living in an area as an Iranian refugee, around the time of the Gulf War. And you're experiencing people's thoughts about what's happening there as well. Tell us about that experience.
What was happening in the first Gulf War when I was in Oklahoma, you mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think people got a very limited view of our entire region of the world. I mean, they had the news coming in about what was happening at the time. It was scary. You know, they didn't really know much about the specifics of Iran. You know, it was a different time. It was before the internet. People hadn't met anyone from the Middle East. And so my family, I think a lot of people were just afraid of us and who we might be, you know. And even though we were Christian converts and we were people who were, you know, kind of chased out of our country by those very bad guys, you know, that's not the way we were received.
Right. What was that like? How did you experience it? Were you ostracized? Were you bullied?
In school, yes. I mean, I was heavily bullied as a child. When I arrived in the fifth grade, actually, I remember there were a couple of weeks at the beginning that were good because the children didn't really know where it was that I was from, you know, and they didn't know what Iran was anyway. And, you know, so I made friends and I was kind of a quiet kid and it was good. And then it took a little while, I suppose, for the parents to get to them, to tell them that this is, you know, that somebody from these bad countries. And slowly the kids started to call me a lot of really ugly names, some of which I can't even say on the radio. Names with, you know, the word camel and turban and things like that in them, which were just generally derogatory about our region of the world. And it made me shrink into myself, and it made me become obsessed with proving myself. And it made me go deeper into academia and thinking, you know what, well, if I can just do well in school, they will see that I have talents and I have worth. It consumed me for my entire childhood.
And what was it, something your parents had prepared you for? Did you have to deal with it with them? Were they experiencing it as well?
Oh, they were shocked too. I mean, my father, mind you, didn't come with us. It was just my mother, my brother, and I. And you know, in Iran, my mother was a respected doctor. In Iran, I was a kind of a popular kid, and everything was fine. And we expected to just start our lives again. But my mother was put to work in a factory in Oklahoma, and she got so much hostility because of her accent. She got so much professional distrust because of that. Even though she was a very good doctor in Iran, she never gained her license again, or really the confidence to work among Americans until, you know, decades later. And I think she was so shocked herself at the friendlessness and the lack of welcome and the fact that she would probably lose her professional identity that, you know, I don't know. I think I was, as a child, I didn't really see all the suffering that she went through. There was this one incident where I remember that she came home from a walk in the park, and she was wearing this little, one of those friendship bracelets. And I said, "Where did you get that?" And she said, "I found it in the park." She said, "I think it's a friendship bracelet from God." And I think it, as a child, then I suddenly realized how very lonely she was.
You just refer to it, sort of threw yourself into your studies, but part of it was about overperforming, proving something mm-hmm. to yourself and to others.
Yeah. I wanted very much to be special again. And I wanted very much for Americans to believe me to be special. And I had fantasies of being, you know, a stellar American and to be unrecognizable as an Iranian and to walk around the streets and just be one of the people who was, you know, one of the best ones, the useful ones, the ones who made a difference. And I just became obsessed with getting into Harvard. I thought it was the only name of a university that anyone in Iran would recognize, that my father would recognize. But the funny thing is, I actually found in this book about college admissions in the public library that to get into top universities in the US, it's not about academics. You have to do well in sports. You have to win all of these trophies. And so I said, okay, I need to win a national championship in a sport. And so how am I going to do this? So I was 12 or 13 at the time, and I'm thinking, okay, I need to find a sport where there's not that much competition. So I went and found Taekwondo, where they handed out trophies and medals by belt, by weight, by gender, by everything. And I started to practice that, and I became obsessed with winning a national championship. and I practiced till my feet bled, and I lost all this weight to drop to a lower weight class, and I did it. I won a national championship. And, I thought, okay, well, this is going to, take me. And the funny thing is, when I would tell my father about this plan, he'd be like, I don't get it. Go to an academic school. Why are you going to sports school? And I said, no. Harvard, believe me, is academic. So anyway, I didn't get into Harvard. I got into Princeton, though.
and yet that experience shaped you and shaped who you are and shaped your becoming a writer and a novelist.
Yes, it did. I mean, I think it was in the camp in Italy that I realized that people make their own stories every day, and that even when they're in a situation of complete waiting, just this limbo, they're still making stories. And then it was in Oklahoma that I realized that I could make stories. I could make my own story. And I became obsessed with what that story would be. And all through college and afterwards, I was always chasing my next story. I still can't look back at the years and not be able to find a good story for each year. It bothers me if I can't, because I think I've wasted that year.
You write about the stories of other refugees as well, and bringing their experience to life too. Talk about why you decided to do that and some of their stories.
Sure. Well, in December 2015, I had my first child, and then 2016 came. So then we had, Trump elected, we had the Brexit vote, I was living in London, and, the world felt very different, and it felt a little bit scary to be reminded of all that I had gone through, because I had become very comfortable as a Westerner. I had, assimilated, I suppose, to Western culture, and suddenly here I was with this very dark little girl, and I didn't know what kind of world she would live in, and I suddenly felt all of this need to say something, but I also felt the need to change the focus of my writing away from myself, because I started to be a little bit sick of myself. To be honest, the world was becoming bigger. It was about not just about me anymore. It was about her, this little girl. And being a mother, I think, makes you very attuned to other people's pain. And I knew that I could now see things that I wouldn't be able to see before. So I decided it's time to go back to a camp, even though I haven't been since I lived in one. And so I called up some refugee, support people around London. And I met this man called Paul Hutchings, who had started a wonderful charity called Refugee Support, where he goes to refugee camps and he sets up grocery stores there so that all the donated food and all the donated clothing is not tossed out of the back of trucks at them, so that they lose their pride and dignity in the process of getting some help. But it's set up in these gorgeous grocery stores where, they come and shop with points, and they can decide if they're going to use all their points on chocolate spread. Nobody does that, by the way. Nobody does that, because people know what they need.
Right.
And so I said, I'm going to come to this camp. And he let me, he gave me a list of all of the, so these are people who live in rows and rows of shipping crates, and each family is in a shipping crate and they're all numbered. And he gave me a list of all the Iranian shipping crates, people with Iranian or Farsi speakers from Afghanistan or Iran. And I went knocking on doors. I would walk down these rows just every day, and I knock on doors, and they would invite me inside, and they would make me a cup of tea. And they were so generous with their stories, and they told me things I could not believe. And then there were moments that were really painful. I mean, there was a moment where a couple asked me to take their child back to England with me.
Wow.
The child was sitting right there with his head down, just resigned to the fate. Yeah.
And because they're just so desperate, right, and worried about, and this as a mom, about the future of their child.
Exactly. And they don't want any more time wasted. I mean, this was a couple whose two of their children had already died. And, you know, they had three other children. Two of them were young enough to be saved. And then there was an older one who had spent so much time in camps that it was too late for him. His own father said it's too late for him. Because what happens is if you wait in a camp for year after year after year, just doing nothing but waiting, and there's no education there, and there's no purpose, you slowly lose your fire and your identity and your sense of purpose. And if you were a kid, you might have been an athletic, you know, intelligent kid who wanted to study and make something of himself. But then after a couple of years, you're just idle. You're just somebody who's looking around and thinking the world is dark and gray. And that's exactly the kind of condition that leads to radicalism, and they had already lost one kid to just complete hopelessness. So they just wanted to save their second son, who was only 9.
Wow. What are some of the sources of hope you see for people to draw upon who are in that kind of a situation?
For the refugees, I think one thing they don't see is how many people in the world care and how many people are watching, how many Western-born people are agonizing over this. And I think that gives me hope, just having met so many of them, and it should give them hope that these systems will be changed and that these problems are being addressed by smart people. But another thing is that once they come into these countries, there are going to be a lot of hostile people, but there are also going to be a lot of incredible loving people. And even among the at first hostile people, there are potentially loving people, because once you meet a person one-on-one, sometimes I think, you know, some of these like older men who are very, very angry in the Midwest, you know, you talk to them for 10 minutes and then you think, oh my God, you have so much in common with my dad. If you sat down for 10 minutes with my dad, the two of you would be in league against me. Okay. So there is not that much difference between people, really, you know, and I think they just need to get to know each other.
It's just why your book is so important. We talk so much about policy addressing, you know, what needs to be changed, but your book tells your personal experience and these personal experiences. Mm-hmm. And I think it's something, you know, people need to open up their hearts about and learn more about. So I want to thank you so much for writing it and for coming on the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
Dina Nayeri is the author of The Ungrateful Refugee, What Immigrants Never Tell You. And of course, you can purchase it in any bookstore. And you can also follow Dina Nayeri on Twitter at Dina, D-I-N-A, Nayeri, N-A-Y-E-R-I. Thank you again, and we'll be back in a couple of minutes.
You're listening to the Michelangelo Signorelli Show on Sirius XM.